Chapter 30. 7 centuries in Asia. Around 50 BC to AD 650. First, Justinian the Great. Second, the Sassanid Empire in Persia. Third, the decay of Syria under the Sassanids. Fourth, the first message from Islam. Fifth, Zoroaster and Mani. Sixth, Hunnish peoples in Central Asia and India. Seventh, the Great Age of China. Eighth, intellectual fetters of China. Ninth, the travels of Huan Xuang. First, in the preceding 2 chapters, we've concentrated our attention chiefly on the collapse, in the comparatively short space of 4 centuries, of the political and social order of the western part of the great Roman Empire of Caesar and Trajan. We've dwelt upon the completeness of that collapse. To any intelligent and public-spirited mind living in the time and under the circumstances of St. Benedict or Cassiodorus, it must have seemed indeed as if the light of civilization was waning and near extinction. But with the longer views a study of universal history gives us, we can view those centuries of shadow as a phase, and probably a necessary phase, in the onward march of social and political ideas and understandings. And if during that time a dark sense of calamity rested upon Western Europe, we must remember that over large portions of the world there was no retrogression. With their Western prepossessions, European writers are much too prone to underrate the tenacity of the Eastern Empire that centered upon Constantinople. This empire embodied a tradition much more ancient than that of Rome. If the reader will look at the map we've given of its extent in the 6th century, and if he'll reflect that its official language had then become Greek, he'll realize that what we're dealing with here is only nominally a branch of the Roman Empire. It's really the Hellenic Empire, of which Herodotus dreamt and which Alexander the Great founded. True, it called itself Roman, and its people Romans, and to this day modern Greek is called Romaic. True also that Constantine the Great knew no Greek, and that Justinian's accent was bad. These superficialities of name and form can't alter the fact that the empire was in reality Hellenic, with a past of 6 centuries at the time of Constantine the Great, and that while the real Roman Empire crumpled up completely in 4 centuries, this Hellenic Roman Empire held out for more than 11, from 312, the beginning of the reign of Constantine the Great, to 1453, when Constantinople fell to the Ottoman Turks. And while we've had to tell of something like a complete social collapse in the West, there were no such equivalent breakdowns in the East. Towns and cities flourished, the countryside was well cultivated, trade went on. For many centuries, Constantinople was the greatest and richest city in the world. We won't trouble ourselves here with the names and follies, the crimes and intrigues of its tale of emperors. As with most monarchs of great states, they didn't guide their empire, they were carried by it. We've already dealt at some length with Constantine the Great, 312-337. We've mentioned Theodosius the Great, 379-395, who for a little while reunited the empire, and Justinian the First, 527-565. Presently we shall tell something of Heraclius, 610-641. Justinian, like Constantine, may have had Slav blood in his veins. He was a man of great ambition and great organizing power, and he had the good fortune to be married to a woman of equal or greater ability, the Empress Theodora, who had in her youth been an actress of doubtful reputation. But his ambitious attempts to restore the ancient greatness of the empire probably overtaxed its resources. As we've told, he reconquered the African province from the Vandals and most of Italy from the Goths. He also recovered the south of Spain. He built the great and beautiful church of Sancta Sophia in Constantinople, founded a university, and codified the law. But against this we must set his closing of the schools of Athens. Meanwhile, a great plague swept the world, and at his death, this renewed and expanded empire of his collapsed like a pricked bladder. The greater part of his Italian conquests was lost to the Lombards. Italy was indeed at that time almost a desert. The Lombard historians assert they came into an empty country. The Avars and Slavs struck down from the Danube country towards the Adriatic, Slav populations establishing themselves in what is now Serbia, Croatia, and Dalmatia to become the Yugoslavs of today. Moreover, a great and exhausting struggle began with the Sassanid Empire in Persia. But before we say anything of this struggle, in which the Persians thrice came near to taking Constantinople, and which was decided by a great Persian defeat at Nineveh in 627, it's necessary to sketch very briefly the history of Persia from the Parthian days. Second, we've already drawn a comparison between the brief 4 centuries of Roman imperialism and the obstinate vitality of the imperialism of the Euphrates-Tigris country. We've glanced very transitorily at the Hellenized Bactrian and Seleucid monarchies that flourished in the eastern half of Alexander's area of conquest for 3 centuries, and told how the Parthians came down into Mesopotamia in the last century BC. We've described the Battle of Carrhae and the end of Crassus. Thereafter, for 2.5 centuries, the Parthian dynasty of the Arsacids ruled in the east, and the Roman in the west, with Armenia and Syria between them, and the boundaries shifted east and west as either side grew stronger. We've marked the utmost eastward extension of the Roman Empire under Trajan, and we've noted that about the same time the Indo-Scythians poured down into India. In 227 occurred a revolution, and the Arsacid dynasty gave way to a more vigorous line, the Sassanid, a national Persian line under Ardashir I. In one respect, the empire of Ardashir I presented a curious parallelism with that of Constantine the Great 100 years later. Ardashir attempted to consolidate it by insisting upon religious unity, and adopted as the state religion the old Persian faith of Zoroaster, of which we shall have more to say later. This new Sassanid empire immediately became aggressive, and under Sapor I, the son and successor of Ardashir, took Antioch. We've already noted how the Emperor Valerian was defeated in 260 and taken prisoner. But as Sapor was retiring from a victorious march into Asia Minor, he was fallen upon and defeated by Odenathus, the Arab king of a great desert trading center, Palmyra. For a brief time under Odenathus and then under his widow Zenobia, Palmyra was a considerable state, wedged between the 2 empires. Then it fell to the Emperor Aurelian, who carried off Zenobia in chains to grace his triumph at Rome in 272. We'll not attempt to trace the fluctuating fortunes of the Sassanids during the next 3 centuries. Throughout that time, war between Persia and the Empire of Constantinople wasted Asia Minor like a fever. Christianity spread widely and was persecuted, for after the Christianization of Rome, the Persian monarch remained the only god-monarch on earth, and he saw in Christianity merely the propaganda of his Byzantine rival. Constantinople became the protector of the Christians and Persia of the Zoroastrians. In a treaty of 422, the one empire agreed to tolerate Zoroastrianism and the other Christianity.